Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with
Thomas Keegan
and
Perry Young,
who star in the new show Junk down at Arena Stage. And when this airs, it will be your last week, your final week to see it as it wraps up on May 5th. Thanks so much for coming in, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you.
It will be the last week, right? There's no plans to extend it or anything?
That's right. We are a must close on May 5th, so get your tickets now.
1 week only. Get them while they're hot.
All right, guys. How have the audiences reacted so far? Any good feedback? People coming up to you afterwards?
Absolutely, yeah. I think audiences in D.C. are so smart and attentive. They've really been engaging with this play and been really excited by it.
Absolutely. And there's an incredible feeling when you're performing for people who actually lived through this and worked through this also. I mean, there's a lot of people that will come up to us and say, you know, I was working these deals in the 80s, in the early 90s. So giving them kind of a refresher of their own life is kind of a wild experience for us as performers.
Absolutely. Before we get too far in, who wants someone take the premise? Someone explain the general plot there.
I'm going to leave Tom to do that.
Sure. Main character here, go.
Yeah, so I play a character named Bob Merkin, who's a junk bond trader and financier in the mid-80s. And essentially, the play details goes through the details of a forced takeover. So this guy, my character is based on a real-life man named Michael Milken. And essentially, their strategy was to raise a great deal of money, many millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, by selling subprime stocks known as junk bonds, and then using that money as leverage to take out a loan against a company in order to take it over. And so these were known as hostile takeovers. And so the play sort of sorts through one of those deals in real time. And you get the financial side of things. You get some politics side of things. There's family drama. There's definitely human stakes, you know, at play, not just financial ones.
Who wants to I want to unpack the, you know, the family drama you mentioned there in a second, but someone want to define for our listeners, in layman's terms, if it's even possible, the idea of a junk bond?
Sure, Perry's deferring to me as well.
That's right. I've done my research and I've done everything on my end, and I defer everything else to
I'm the lawyer. Leave the legalities
exactly.
to me, right?
Big short it with us. Let's have a pop culture cutaway while explain it.
Well, yeah. if you think about, you know, the bonds are rated for their the confidence that you can have that the company will be able to pay back, you know, the loan with its interest, and those ratings range from triple C to triple AAA, or single, I don't, you know, single C to AAA, and anything I think it's below double B rating is considered a junk bond.
Yeah.
Now, you can listen to, you know, really smart people talk about the current use of junk bonds. Look, Netflix just bought $2 billion worth of junk bonds to fund their next 7 years of projects.
I just saw the article a couple days ago.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's still happening today. And I mean, and these new companies that don't have as much confidence in the market, you know, brand new companies, Uber, Netflix, are still considered junk bonds, which is kind of wild to us because they're huge. Yep. They're huge, huge companies, but they're still offering higher returns because they're not as well established. So. Right.
Gotcha. So yeah, it's essentially it's a higher risk debt that you're taking on. That's where the term junk comes from, the idea that they're not actually worth something.
You know? Cool. Just wanted to hit that real fast. We won't get our listeners too far in the
My character is quick in the play to point out that it's a misnomer. Yeah. So I'll take his side and tell you it is a misnomer.
And it's a rabbit hole that you can go down. So
I'm like, note to self. Let's. That'll be boring radio if we spend the whole time talking.
Oh, dude, are you
family
kidding me?
Drama. Let's go.
I did so much research on the numbers and stuff, and I could look down and read and intellectually understand what arbitrage is, and then I look up and look you in the eye, and I have no idea how to explain it to you. So you know, you're right to steer us away from all that stuff.
I promise you,
we make it clear in the play.
Yeah, we had to get hit on it really fast. See the play to, you know, hash it out. But family drama you mentioned. Who? Explain what you mean.
Yeah. Well, in the play. My wife plays a very important role in not only my life, but in the inner workings of how I look at the financial world. She has an MBA herself and has had a career on Wall Street. We have a newborn son in the play. And then, of course, the company that I'm trying to take over is run by a man who's running his father's company, whose grandfather started the company. And there's this idea of legacy and succession and what we pass on, you know, for posterity and to future generations. And along with that, because there was a lot and continues to be of ethnic prejudice in mm-hmm. corporate America in the mid-80s, we have people who are seeking to break into the financial markets and into certain levels of the finance world for the first time, and they are fighting the battles of their parents before them.
Right. And it's interesting. I mean, when you talk about the idea of family, there's blood family and then there's chosen family. And within this show, there is this idea of it's kind of us versus them. And, you know, them being the old guard and the new guard being this new young upstart group of people that are trying to break into this world that was not available to them. And so even though there's no blood relations, I mean, our characters are essentially brothers in the show. We are ride or die. He has my back. I have his back the entire way. And so this idea of chosen family also and being the other within the show gives us this kind of this blood-like bond.
What's your character's name?
Oh,
tell us about him.
Yeah, so I play
we went into Robert.
Oh, that's right. No, I've let him talk enough. That's right. Yeah. my character is Raul Rivera, and I play his legal aide, his top legal aide. And there's a relationship there that is kind of unspoken, our backstory. But in doing my own research, his character, who he's based off of, had a best friend growing up that went to high school together. They went to college together. They were fraternity brothers, and he turned into Michael Milken's top legal aide. And I think that my character has to be directly lifted from that because we have such a bond. I have a relationship with his family. We talk about things that have happened in the past. And while it's not expressly stated within the show, there's a huge backstory there.
There's a moment where I talk emotionally about my father and his experience, and he expresses a clear understanding of who my father was.
Absolutely. And so that kind of again deepens this idea of chosen family. You know, when you are the other, you kind of bring other people that have been ostracized, that have been you know, shut out from this world together, and we create this kind of brotherhood.
Our own tribe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Talk about you mentioned just a few seconds ago that how big of a role the setting plays, that it was in the '80s, and a lot of people in the audience might have even lived through that themselves. Explain how that factors in. Is there like a Wall Street vibe or a Glengarry Glenn Ross kind of vibe or Margin Call, Big Short?
For all the greasy, slicked back hair.
Come for the witty repartee, stay for the suits. I'm glad you brought up Glengarry because Ayad Akhtar, who wrote this play and came to talk to us the first day we worked on it, referred to it as a Mametian Shakespeare play, meaning of the world of David Mamet and of William Shakespeare. And I think that you see we have a lot of sort of fast-paced, quick. These are brilliant people who think as they speak, and so it's very exciting to watch them mm-hmm. work through problems. And then you have other really broad, big ideas that, like in Shakespeare, have to get projected out and laid out very clearly because they're rhetorical and they are sort of the heart of the play. So you get these two sort of forces working in concert together.
Yeah, and these archetypal characters that exist in Shakespeare at the same time in the world of Mamet and kind of in our everyday world, these people are just at the top of their game. They are so smart. They are so spot on, and they do not make mistakes. And that's the other thing. So it puts a lot of pressure on us as performers, because when you're walking in being the smartest person in the room, you have to act like it. You have to look like it. You have to speak like it. You have to be on your A game at all points. So there's no rest within this show. It is a tornado
right,
of a show.
2 hours, no intermission, right? Yeah. You have to be on.
And we're performing in the round, too, right? So we're surrounded by audience on all sides. We have four entrances and exits. And as you'll see if you come to see the play, the set is very minimal. And so the storytelling, it really relies on us. And so there is a sort of Sorkin-esque quality to mm-hmm. it, right? We want to keep it moving. We want it to feel like a walk and talk. And these people, very often, you'll see again if you see the play, these scenes sort of begin in flagrante, right? We're in the middle of the scene when mm-hmm. we start, and there's a sense that something has just happened and that something will continue to happen when the scene ends, because it doesn't just come to a conclusion. He sort of gets the information across he needs to get across, and suddenly over on the other side of the stage, there are two new people mm-hmm. in the middle of a new conversation. Mm-hmm. And so our director, Jackie Maxwell, who we both revere very much, has done, I think, a really beautiful job of moving the eye around the stage and keeping the story clipping mm-hmm. along the way it wants to be.
I love you're dropping all these cool new terms. Mimetian.
Mimetian.
Sorkin-esque.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man.
Now it's Maxwellian.
Maxwellian. I have tried to coin Maxwellian. I'm all about that.
But she's in Toronto right now just shaking her head.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the playwright, though. Ayad Akhtar, Pulitzer Prize winner, because I thought Disgraced was one of my favorite shows I ever saw at Arena. I remember we had the cast in here. And it was just, it was like, it was set in that post 9/11 sort of the fear mongering, the xenophobia that happened around then. But it was using that setting not too long ago in the past, similar to your show here, to comment on the now. So how does being set in the 80s, I mean, it's kind of obvious, but how does it comment on the now? We have guys crossing moral boundaries. Mm. And is redemption even possible?
Yeah, I mean, it's cyclical, you know? It shows how we notice things in the past, but somehow cannot get away from them. And there are, you know, countless examples of that in the very near or distant past, but near past as well, and the now. You know, there's these Wall Street executives, bailouts that are happening, and people are just getting slaps on the wrist, you know, just fines. No jail time, hardly ever. And this show is kind of the origin story of that, of how these big banks and how these Wall Street execs were doing some dirt behind the scenes. And when they get caught, there's still not the gratifying...
Too big to fail, right?
Yeah. There's still not the gratifying moment. It's like, oh, the villain got caught. If he is a villain even, you know, he changed the game. But there's these moments when you're like, oh, he's going to come down hard. He's going to come down hard. And you don't really ever get that. And it's the same way when you see reports today of things like that happening, that you're like, oh, something has to have changed. But unfortunately, something has not changed.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we don't need to get too modern day political, but, you know, we are... This is a play about moral ambiguity. There are no heroes in this
right.
play. There's maybe one character that has a true moral center, and he's by design, he doesn't appear very often.
Which one would that be?
There's an assistant U.S. attorney who is assisting as sort of Giuliani-like character. And he says at one point, can I just want to do my job? Is that really so hard for you to understand? Right? The idea that he doesn't have an ulterior motive is like foreign to everyone
right.
around him.
He sticks out like a sore
right.
thumb.
Right. And by design, he's one of the smallest characters because... Right. Because he's not interesting in this
and
world.
And you don't get to have a voice when that's your perspective in this world,
yeah.
right? So, you know, I do think that, as Perry said, you know, there is a cyclical nature to this, right? There's a reason that we do mention the housing crisis of 2008 and the subprime mortgage crisis, but it's a sort of illusion that happens later in the play. And I think part of the reason that Ayad has set the play in this time period is that it is something we can remember, but we're a little more emotionally removed from it, right? And it's interesting to watch something that's a period piece and then start realizing through the course of the play that, oh, gosh, not much has changed, right? And, you know, as you say, like, Mike Milken did go to prison. He went to prison for 2 years. When he came out, he had $2.1 billion. You decide if that's justice.
Is it? No.
Yeah, you decide if that's justice. You know, it certainly isn't to the people, the factory workers who lost their jobs in middle America because, you know, their companies were cut apart. And again, there's another side of that argument too, which I make in the play, which is that he didn't kill those jobs. Those jobs were dying anyway.
Right.
You know, China's steel is more valuable than our steel because they make it cheaper and it's more quickly produced. And right. we're not a production company anymore. Now we've hired for the job of president someone who's going to tell us that these jobs are coming back. And, you know, we're not. We're in a post-industrial age in America.
And it's a manufacturing company that your business, the family, that's the
yeah,
family
it's a steel company that we're going after. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think the idea of culpability and where justice fits into all this this is not a polemic, this play. This play asks a lot of questions. Certainly, I think Ayad has his point of view. And if you ever hear him talk, he's one of the most erudite, eloquent people you'll ever hear speak. He speaks like he sat down and wrote what he's saying off the cuff.
Yeah.
But he certainly has his point of view, but I think he, for the most part, restrains himself from asserting that point of view on the play and instead asks the questions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea of too big to fail is sort of here already, right? Like, this guy has so much power that he's amassed. These people have amassed so much power when you amass this kind of wealth. That we end up with sort of what the Mueller report has given us, right? Which is what Nixon said, which is, I'm saying if the president does it, it isn't illegal.
Right.
And the question becomes, right, when you have a certain amount of power, wealth is, we care about more about wealth than anything else in this country. Mm-hmm. And wealth gives you the opportunity to buy yourself out of the responsibilities of citizenship, but maintain all of the rights. And
that's profound right there, man.
It makes you, you a man without a country, you know, and you are. And so it's so interesting to me that, you know, all these people who are demanding border security are people for whom borders mean nothing.
Right. Yeah. Of
you know, they have no borders in their life. No, it's a fascinating point you said. There's a lot of hurting people that out there that in a heartbeat would take that deal of 2 years in prison to come out a millionaire. You know, like how many people would do this?
Sign me up anytime.
Yeah.
Sign me up anytime.
Is that the line of the play? Sign me up anytime.
Absolutely.
No, it's I will say, and because I don't want to paint sort of heroes and villains, you know, of these people, certainly of the real people, because we all have our own human motivations. And sure. I think very few people wake up with malevolence in their hearts. At least that's the way I choose to go through the world.
Well, I'd like to think.
But, you know, Mike Milken did go to prison, and I don't know what that's like. You know, we can call it a country club all we want, but he had two kids and he was locked away from them and he developed cancer while he was there. And since he has formed an institute that has provided so much money for cancer research and, you know, other philanthropic causes, that I think it's important to remember that, you know, we contain multitudes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's the human, man.
Yeah, that's right.
I want to circle back because I pivoted back to Akhtar, but tell me what Maxwellian direction would be. what is her we joked about that, but seriously, like, what's sort of like her approach compared to the other directors?
She is one of the more awe-inspiring directors that I've worked with in a very long time. She has the ability to get her point of view across, but also she is not shy about, dare I say, stealing ideas. But I mean, it's a community.
Embracing
Perry. Ideas. Thank you. Thank
welcoming
you. I'm sorry.
Ideas.
That was a nice little edit.
Nice job,
right there.
Robert.
No, she
No, Perry, don't use that word.
Don't use that word. This is going to get me in trouble. No, she embraces the idea of a community show. You know, she has so much to offer right when we walk in the door, and she's willing to hear your ideas, and she wants the best production on that stage, whether it's her idea, whether it's your idea, whether it's somebody else's idea. And she has given us the freedom that is pretty rare in the theater to bring our own ideas to the stage and watch them sink or swim, you know?
She runs a meritocracy.
Yeah.
Which is rare in, I mean, any profession, right? You know, it doesn't feel like a dictatorship. She has clear ideas and she has the final say, but I always feel like my voice is heard.
Mm-hmm.
And she has, and this is a real gift that is not unique to her, but it's rare. She has a way of speaking to each actor as an individual. And I think it can be very challenging when you're looking at the big scope of an artistic production to remember that you're dealing with you know, artists in their own right who come with their own insecurities and fears and concerns and ideas and all the rest. And she doesn't approach each person as automatons. She approaches them as approaches Perry as Perry and Thomas as Thomas. And I did a play with her a couple of years ago called Watch on the Rhine at Arena Stage in the same space that we're in now. Yeah. And I said soon after that, I hope it never comes to it because I would follow her into hell.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very easy. We have 17 people in our cast. And there isn't a bad face. There isn't a bad apple in the bunch. That comes by way of two things, I think. That one is casting, you know.
Yeah.
But it's top-down leadership. The attitude when you come in the room is positive. You know, she's on time. She's smiling. She's ready to work. She is encouraging and at the same time gives guidance where it's needed.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I had a lot to do in this play. I'm on stage half of the play. And I was so grateful and remain grateful for the hands-on approach she took with me. She talked, anytime we talked about the play, she talked about the character that she and I were building together. You know, when it came time for, you know, her to give me some notes that were hard to hear, she sat me down privately and talked to me about how she thinks I could refocus. You know, it was always generous and when it was critical, it was benevolently and kindly critical,
right? Yeah.
You know, and there's a way to give criticism that keeps people's feelings in mind.
There's
she's mastered.
There's such a way that you can speak to actors that it can go either way, where you can feel attacked. You can feel like your artistry, your choices are being attacked, or it can feel like she's inspiring you to do better. She's inspiring you for greatness.
I see what you're doing, and here's how you could do even better.
Yeah, and I felt like I walked into the room, and she set the bar so high that I was already on board. I was all ready to do the best that I could do. And I knew when I wasn't hitting the mark. And when she would talk to me and she would give me notes, that her ideas were just kind of instilling themselves within me. And she has such a beautiful way of talking to actors who are notoriously sensitive, you know, for taking notes and taking criticism. And she just hands down is one of the best people that I've ever worked with to inspire that within me.
And it's others. Contagious, right? When you watch your deal with somebody that way, and you start talking to each other as colleagues more generously.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You don't sit there and build negative narratives of people in your head if they're not doing the thing that you think they should be doing. It's like she asks you to focus on your work and gets you to trust that she's focusing on the rest. And as an artist, that's such a gift, mm-hmm. because it's a complicated thing to form a character. And this is a fast-paced play with a lot of complicated ideas and words. So all the other stuff she took on her shoulders and made us feel confident that we all only had to focus on our work.
And she does it in such a delightfully cheeky way also.
Yeah, and she's
just
funny.
Just keeps it light and keeps it fun.
A little behind the scenes, you know, we opened the play a couple of weeks ago and I've been doing the play for about a week, 9 or so performances. Mm-hmm. And I was discussing with the stage manager the final moment of the play, which I won't reveal or anything like that, but there were sort of two ways to go with it. And she said, look, get on the phone with Jackie. And I got on the phone with Jackie, and we had discussed this many times and the tenor of what the moment should be, and we had never really landed on anything before she left. And I said, you know, if it's okay with you, I'd like the permission to sort of feel it in the moment and decide what the audience is asking for the moment to be. And her exact words were, I trust you implicitly, it's yours. Wow. And that, you know, not only for her to do that from Toronto, where she's directing August Osage County, by the way. Why talk about going from one to the other?
Seriously, very different.
Very different and epic in its own way. But, you know, to not even be seeing it, but to trust from working mm-hmm. with me and knowing me that I would respect what we built together and, you know, and honor that in that moment. She wasn't prescriptive. She left mm-hmm. it up. That's just special.
That's really beautiful.
Yeah. Well, there you go, folks. That's Maxwellian right there.
That's Maxwellian. Yeah.
Hey, she's
out. Wester.
There are several DC actors I know who have said that she's on our Mount Rushmore of directors. So if you see a play directed by Jackie Maxwell, you know, if you have the opportunity to, please do. Like this one.
Ooh.
Dare I ask who else is on the Mount Rushmore?
Tricky territory.
This one, your co-stars really fast because there's an all-star lineup here. I mean, Ed Giro Scalia / Scrooge. We've seen him in everything.
That's right. He almost crashed this party.
I love that guy.
I think he's about playing 18 holes today, or he'd be here with us.
Oh,
but,
my God.
He's great. You know, Ed's a mentor of mine. He was an instructor of mine in graduate school, and one of the people who I learned the most from while I was there. In fact, at the end of my year, I wrote him a letter and said, you know, as much. And his response was, come have lunch at the house. Yada, yada, yada. He spoke at my wedding. And now this is the first play we're getting a chance to do together. And we share a dressing room, which we've decked out and we dubbed the boardroom.
Oh, my God.
And we have visitors each evening.
That's right.
From the cast. They come up and hang out in the boardroom. But Ed's a giant, and getting to work with him is incredible.
And who else we got?
Oh my God. I mean, come on. There's the amazing thing is I was blissfully unaware of the world that I was entering in the DC scene. So when I walk into rehearsal, I mean, I'm meeting my castmates for the first time, and I'm meeting David, and I'm meeting Ed Giro, and I'm meeting these legends that I didn't know about. And so I get to walk in the room blissfully unaware of who these people are. Hey, how's it going? I'm Perry. And then actually do my research later on and be like, oh, I'm talking to a living legend right there, you know? And that's, I mean, Johnny Martin is one of the guys that we get to work with, and we've been dubbed the Three Amigos within our show.
Yeah, that happened quickly.
Really fast. Really fast. I mean, it works within the idea of what the what the show is, and then also for kind of how we relate to each other outside of the theater. So,
and you know, to give you an idea of, I mean, Jonathan, who Perry just brought up, was just in the Eris at Arena, mm-hmm. and he just started rehearsals while we're still in performances for a play at Woolly Mammoth. I mean, he's one of the busiest actors in Washington. Shannara Gabriel plays my wife. She's terrific. Seasoned DC veteran Michael mm-hmm. Glenn plays a wonderful character track, wonderfully profane character track, mm-hmm. I might add. There are a lot of familiar faces from DC, and then Jackie found some wonderful people, including Perry from outside.
Early, another local DC actor.
DC
so
staple.
It's amazing. I mean, there's four of us that are from out of town, but the rest of them are local talent, and that's what's great for me to be coming from New York and LA and realize that there is a kind of a homegrown theater scene here of some incredibly inspiring actors that I have the privilege of calling friends now and you know, co-stars.
Yeah.
Yeah, tell me, I want to know a little bit, you mentioned that, you know, you're sort of a outside to the DC group.
I'm the outsider.
I want to know more about you guys, your own little trajectory.
Yeah,
so where'd you grow up and how'd you get it?
So I grew up just outside of San Francisco in Berkeley, and I grew up on stage, but dancing and singing, kind of did the musical theater route when I was really young, and that stuck with me. Went to college, did musical theater, and then I moved out to New York shortly after that, and I got the amazing opportunity to play Usnavi on the In the Heights National Tour, and that kind of was my baby, my bread and butter for the past 5 years. And I love that show just about more than anything. And so my trajectory was kind of going more into the musical theater world in New York. And then actually very recently, right before I did this show, I decided to move back to California and go to LA and try to break into the film and TV world, which is kind of what I was most recently doing. And then this phone call comes to come audition for this show and bring me right back out to the East Coast in a show and a play that I am just so thrilled to be able to jump into. I mean, it's so vastly different from anything that I've done in my most recent past. To jump into a play that is so wordy and so meaty, and the characters are so real, and the dialogue is just cutthroat. I mean, it's incredible. And to get this opportunity to come out to DC and kind of make my DC regional debut. So that was my most immediate past, and then be able to jump in here and kind of have the time of my life doing it.
Just when you think you're out,
I know,
it pulls you back in.
Pull me back in. I thought I was gone. I thought I was out of here.
Not so fast, Perry.
One good thing that Godfather 3 gave us.
Oh my God.
We know each other a little from a past life, indie, you know, the short film world. But remind our listeners, you know, where you're from and
yeah.
How you
absolutely. Well, you know, I'm an actor, so I've been a bit of a vagabond throughout my life. But I was born in Delaware, and insofar as I was raised in Massachusetts, and then did my undergrad at the University of Delaware. Did some vagabond years after that in my early professional acting days, and then graduate school brought me here to DC in 2009. I graduated in 2010, and pretty immediately started working on stage here. I'm fortunate to say, and have been, you know, doing a few plays a year here and there since. I did a TV show on AMC called Turn, Washington mm-hmm. Spies, which is about spies during the American Revolution, and did the first year of that. And, you know, it's a challenging thing to negotiate. Most of the TV in this country gets cast in New York and L.A., and so I've done a little bit of bouncing up to New York and done a couple of TV shows up there. But that is where some of my focus is going right now. My wife, who's also an actress and is actually out in San Francisco right now doing mm-hmm. a play.
Come in here, I think, a couple times. So,
yeah, she's been here too. You know, we have a family here. I have a 4.5-year-old, and we've had wonderful careers here. And, you know, I think it's been a little tough to try to do the TV thing and the film thing at the same time. So we have a move to New York planned in the summer. But, you know, I was just saying to Perry on the way over here that even though I've made this great plan to move to New York, all these DC theaters are like, well, why don't you come in and read for this?
Right,
I'm like,
yeah.
Well, that's a great play. And
I would train right away, man.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, the life of an artist is one I've been very fortunate in being able to sort of roll with the punches,
mm-hmm.
you know, the best laid plans, you know, everybody's got a plan that I get punched in the face, right? And I have another priority now. I mean, before I'm an actor, I'm a dad and a husband, and you know, I have to provide for him. And mostly what I want to do is just show him, like, go after what you love, you know, and you know, plans be damned.
Yeah. Seriously. I mean, wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah. Well, if you do make the move, make sure you leave us your junk.
Yeah.
That's come the best bring way I can it bring back. It back around.
Come see our junk.
Come see our junk. You gotta be careful.
Yeah. That'll be cut.
In closing, why should our folks come out to Arena Stage to see this show? I usually like just end on that because the interview, they get warmed up after about a half hour, and then I get the best sound bites at the very end.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Why should they come on out?
Wow, that's a great question. I mean, I think you come out for a play that is going to grab you. From the moment that you walk in that door and the moment that you sit down and the play starts, it grabs you. It does not release you for 2 hours. And it's kind of this incredible whirlwind of just a fast-paced world for a a part of the part of our culture and part of our world that maybe the top 1% really know about, and it just dives in, and you'll come out smarter, you'll come out a little savvier, and hopefully you'll come out with some questions as to where your own moral compass lies. It's an incredible reflection of American culture and this idea of who are the heroes and who are the villains and who do you really side with. I mean, there's a lot of questions, and I think that's the beautiful part about the play is there's not as many answers. It just leaves you with a lot of questions. So I think that's the reason it comes in.
Yeah, and I would just say, why do you ever come to the theater? You know, it's a communal experience. There's a reason it's at Arena Stage. Arena is the center for American storytelling in Washington, D.C., and I dare say the country.
Not just D.C., yeah.
I dare say the country. I think it's the preeminent American regional theater. And I said that well before I ever worked here. But working here has only solidified that opinion for me. This is an American story. It's an American story about greed and excess and the dangers of capitalism. Not to bring it back too political at the end, but we just had a former Fed chair say capitalism is more important than democracy with a straight face. This is an American story that's affecting us right now. You know, tens of thousands of people took their lives because they lost their homes in 2008 because bankers broke the law. Those bankers haven't gone to prison. And that's tribal upset. There's a miscarriage of justice in that we are all grappling with. And the biggest problem facing our country today is the economic disparity between the top and the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, for Washington audiences who many of whom do very well and wear white collars to work, I think there is a little bit of, self-reckoning you have to deal with. You know, we all live in a capitalist, mm-hmm. Economy, but where is our moral responsibility for that? You know, so as I said, come for the story, stay for the nice suits.
Yeah.
Once again, with the better sound bites at the end. Thanks, guys. Again, it's Junk at Arena Stage, the last week here, now through Sunday, May 5th. So make sure you check it out. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you.